May it please the court. Rule 24...
Could you... In the hallway, could you please shut the door? Thank you. I didn't want you to be interrupted. So I did it myself. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Rule 24035 movements, such as Mr. Ryan, frequently raise claims challenging the validity of their pleas based on ineffective assistance of counsel. And in a lot of those cases, the record is determined, either in whole or in part, not to wholly support the Rule 24035 post-conviction movement's claims. The state may argue that Mr. Ryan's case is such a case, where the record refutes the claim that counsel coerced an involuntary plea. However, what distinguishes Mr. Ryan's case from the majority of other post-conviction cases that are filed with this claim is that the plea was taken as part of a group plea procedure. The use of group pleas has been widely criticized and repeatedly criticized by the courts and by members of the bar. The use of the practice has been determined to affect the voluntariness of pleas.
Did he raise that issue in his post-conviction motion?
He did not raise an issue about the group plea in his post-conviction motion. However, review of the court's use of the group plea procedure at the plea is a part of this court's review of the entirety of the record and the totality of the circumstances surrounding the plea.
Prior to the Court of Appeals opinion, did he make that argument?
No. Well, he made it in the brief, in the appellate court brief filed in the Eastern District. That argument was made. And then
was it a separate point relied on, or was it simply part of the factual context discussed in the argument?
It was part of the factual context discussed in part of the argument. It was not raised as a separate point on appeal.
Does that mean it's not preserved in this court? You understand the intent of both those questions. Is that issue that you want to present about the group plea really presented here?
I think that Mr. Ryan did all that he should be required to do in order to obtain and justify this court's review of the plea court's use of the group plea procedure by timely filing a pro se motion, timely filing an amended motion, alleging that his plea was coerced and that his plea is involuntary as a result of plea counsel's actions. The review of the use of the group plea procedure is not something that Mr. Ryan is only entitled to unless he raises a claim that specifically relates to it. This court has to review that record.
And our court has, in prior cases, reviewed the record and reviewed in our recent case where we addressed the use of a group plea and how that added to confusion. But here, he's not claiming any confusion factually. What did he say about the group plea that contributed to confusion? I didn't see any allegations. In our prior case, they failed to recognize the conflict of interest because they failed to talk to the two parties about the fact they're represented by the same counsel and about the factual history of the pleas that created a conflict of interest. What is it here about the group plea that you're alleging created a problem? And the second part, please get to, the Court of Appeals created a shifting of the burden test, basically, and can you address that also?
Well, in the first instance, he alleged in his claim that counsel had made certain statements that had coerced him into entering a guilty plea. Now, he did not specifically allege in his amended motion how the use of a group plea procedure affected his responses to the plea court's inquiries about threats or promises or any pressure that might have induced his plea. However, that argument has been made on appeal here, and the argument is that had the group plea procedure not been utilized in this case, that his answers might have been different. Group pleas are inherently coercive. Participation in a group plea procedure such as the one here, where you have a group of defendants who are all going along with the program, meaning that they're all persisting in their pleas of guilty and saying all the right things to get their pleas accepted, participation in that type of group plea procedure plays on the defendant's psychological need to conform and for acceptance. and also brings to bear upon the defendant a type of group-associated peer pressure that is not present in individualized plea.
And you agree, none of that's in your amended motion?
No, none of that was pleaded in the amended motion.
And none of that was addressed or evidence of that was introduced at the trial court level. Is that correct?
No, there was no opportunity to present any evidence at the motion court level because there was no hearing granted.
And so the Court of Appeals dealt with that by saying if there's a group plea, we're going to always require an evidentiary hearing where these can come out. Can you address that as a remedy? And what is there any foundation for that kind of approach in our prior case law?
I think that there is a foundation for that approach, as this court has disapproved of group pleas in the past and has indicated that they are not recommended.
And I ask because normally, though, I mean, if there were factual allegations in the petition that as to why the group plea had affected the voluntariness of the plea, those might require an evidentiary hearing. But in the absence of that, the Court of Appeals said you're just automatically entitled to one from the fact of a group plea. That's going a step beyond anything prior cases have done. Do we have to take that step in your case, and why is it a wise step or why not?
I think that is a wise step because the group plea procedure continues to be utilized by the same circuit involved in Mr. Ryan's case, despite many admonitions and
A claim could be made that counsel was ineffective for not objecting to the group plea.
A claim could have been made at the time the amended motion was filed that counsel was ineffective for failing to object to the group
plea. And that
plea
would raise the issue that counsel knew that the court said spoken with disfavor about group pleas, but that wasn't the claim that was made.
No, that claim was not raised, and we're asking for this court's review of the use of the group plea procedure in this instance, sua sponte, without that issue actually being raised as part of the court's review of the entirety of the record in determining the merits, possible merits of Mr. Ryan's claim.
Wouldn't you be asking this court to do what we say we won't even allow the motion courts to do, and that would be to sua sponte amend your post-conviction motion? I mean, we don't even let the motion courts amend the amended motion to add allegations that aren't contained in it.
I'm not asking the court to amend the motion sua sponte. What I'm asking the court to do is to review the entirety of the record. And as part of that, this court can't help but to review that there was a group plea used.
If we look at the record, the entirety of the transcript from the entering of the guilty plea, what do we see in that record that supports a claim of coercion?
Well, this was an assembly line group plea procedure involving seven defendants.
No, that supports the claim of coercion by counsel, not by the court, not by the group plea process, but by counsel, which is the claim that he alleged.
There are no facts that would support that allegation there in the record. But this is the case in the majority of post-conviction cases. Evidentiary hearings are necessary to flesh out those
If it goes back for an evidentiary hearing, the evidence is going to be what he said to his counsel, what his counsel said to him or didn't say to him, or whether they had conversations and when they had them and how they had them. It isn't going to have anything to do with the group plea process.
That's correct. It would be a credibility determination that the court would make based on the testimony that was presented, and then the court would determine the merit of the claim that counsel coerced the plea. However, in determining whether or not Mr. Ryan is entitled to an evidentiary hearing to prove this claim, this court should take into consideration the fact that the group plea procedure was used in this instance.
What other facts in the future are we supposed to add to go against our rule that says you only get an evidentiary hearing when you allege facts that aren't refuted by the record? I mean, where does that end?
Well, I think that the record itself cannot conclusively refute the allegation because it is taken as part of a group plea procedure where the court conducts the inquiries required under Rule 2402B and C by addressing the group of defendants en masse as opposed to addressing them individually.
To restate your position, you're asking us for a ruling that the record can never be refuted when there is can never refute the claims when there's a group plea.
I know this court's reluctance to find that group pleas are per se impermissible. And I think that every case is individual and should be decided on the facts and the circumstances of this case. In this instance, you have a post-conviction movement who is alleging that his plea was coerced. And his plea was taken as part of an inherently coercive group plea procedure. And within that group plea procedure, the court very seldom addresses the defendants individually or personally when discussing those rights that the court is required to advise them of pursuant to Rule 24.
Well, did the court address counsel here individually about whether we require a litany of more specific questions because we've said you can't refute, say it's refuted on the record by just a very general question, did counsel do everything you want? We require specific questions, but weren't those asked here and answered?
There were general questions asked. The usual questions, the litany of questions that almost every judge knows to ask before accepting a plea, those were the types of questions that were asked.
But the reason we require those, and they used to be one general question, we've required a number of more specific ones precisely because of the kind of concern you raise that people are confused, they think they're supposed to say yes, so the court asks specific questions. What is the point of that process if we're not going to believe it, if defendant can say, I lied then, because counsel coerced me to? That was the whole point of requiring the specific questions, and then we've said you can't then say, I was lying then, and get a hearing, because that defeats the whole purpose of the process.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the court requiring that those questions be asked. What I am saying is that the record of the answers to those questions has less reliability when it is made in the course of a group plea procedure where they are not individually addressed to the defendant.
And that's what I was trying to, did any of you not get help from counsel and they're supposed to answer in a course, or did the court go through each person individually?
It appears from the transcript that the court asks the general question and then turns to this person, then the next person, then the next on down the
line. And your argument is inherently they're influenced by what the people before them say, and they think that's what they're supposed to say, and they don't understand they can independently answer that.
They can be, but also in the group plea procedure, there's the additional pressure of having to interrupt not only the court, but also the defendant who is pleading guilty next to you.
Did the movement say that he had talked to his counsel 10 times for approximately 4 hours?
He did say that he talked to him for...
Does he allege that the group plea process somehow caused that answer to be incorrect or truncated?
No, he doesn't make an allegation with respect to that. I will ask this court to note that in the amended motion, he did allege that counsel failed to talk with him or visit with him sufficiently, but that claim was dropped on appeal, and it was also not carried forward on appeal in this court. So the claim about failing to meet with him is not raised here.
Thank you, counsel.
Returning to that point of the claim of failing to not meet with him is not raised here. It's part and parcel of the claim that was raised. There was just one claim that was raised in this case, which was that counsel was ineffective and caused the guilty plea to be unknowing, unintelligent, involuntary, because counsel failed to do three things, one of which was to meet with him beforehand, longer than a few minutes beforehand, and to talk to him, and the second one was to talk to him substantively about the case. And the third one was to tell him that if you don't take this plea, you might get a very harsh sentence. Well, if the claim is being dropped that counsel failed to talk to them, I'm not sure what remains, except for this group plea proceeding. And, you know,
Well, the third one is not directly, is the third point there directly refuted by the record? I take it your argument is the first two are directly refuted
yes.
by specific factual statements made at the plea.
Yes.
What about the third, about the pressure?
The third one, I believe, failed to state facts warranting relief. And the reason why is because the mere fact that counsel says to you, you know, you're facing a very harsh sentence if you don't take this plea on a reduced, you know, charge for a Class B as opposed to the Class A, that's just advice. That's prediction. That's what we expect counsel to tell people when they're making a decision between two choices that come before them.
Isn't their argument that they didn't find out about the consecutive concurrent until that day, and that was confusing? And
yeah, the part of the argument was that counsel didn't talk to him until a few minutes beforehand and tell him that it was consecutive versus concurrent. What I'm hearing today is that part of the allegation, at least in part, is being abandoned. That counsel did talk to him for approximately 4 hours over the course of 10 meetings. But here's the other part of that, and which is this, is that if counsel comes to him and says, well, here's what the state's plea offer is. There was no allegation in this case, for instance, that counsel had learned about the state's plea offer or a change in the plea offer weeks before or days before and had failed to tell the defendant. All we have is that counsel came to him and said, here's what the state's plea offer is. Now, it may have been that there was a short time period.
Well, I think her argument is that's what the evidentiary hearing she wants is for, to flesh that out.
Well, and to the extent that the argument is that evidentiary hearings are necessary to flesh out facts, I think that that's backwards. An evidentiary hearing is the purpose of that is to prove the facts that have been alleged in the motion. And here we don't have any facts suggesting that counsel did anything wrong in advising the defendant a few minutes beforehand that the state's plea offer was X, Y, and Z. If counsel received that 10 minutes before from the state and said, hey, this is what the state is offering, it was counsel's obligation to tell the defendant this is the state's plea offer, even if the plea offer had changed. In fact, precisely because it had changed, counsel would have been under an obligation to communicate that offer to the defendant. Under Missouri versus Frye, counsel always has an obligation to communicate plea offers to the defendant whenever they're extended. But there wasn't any allegation, for instance, that counsel sat on this offer or this alleged change in the plea offer for days or weeks and failed to attempt to communicate it with the defendant or failed to communicate it at all. What we have is merely an allegation that counsel came and told me, this is what the state's plea offer is. Well, he had some time to think about that. If he felt that he was being pressured, he also had an opportunity to tell the court during the group plea proceeding that he felt pressured. The court asked him, were there any threats or pressure of any kind exerted on you to get you to enter this plea?
What about counsel's point that it's inherent in that group plea process that as you're going down the line and you're the fifth person out of six or eight or whatever, then everybody said, no, Your Honor, no, Your Honor, that you're supposed to say, no, Your Honor, and that's what you're going to do?
A couple of thoughts along those lines. Two. First of all, to the extent that it is alleged now to be inherent in the process, I think that that allegation would need to be included in the amended motion. But more importantly, this, which is that if the defendant was feeling that, or if the defendant looked over the record and said, you know, when I said that, I was just feeling a lot of pressure, then he should have alleged that fact in the motion. He should have said, the reason why I gave some of the responses I gave is because I felt compelled by the circumstances to give those responses. But there's nothing like that in the amended motion. In fact, the amended motion doesn't even mention the fact that this plea was part of a group plea. So to the extent, and the way I read the cases is the cases acknowledge that there's a risk that these sorts of events could come about, that somebody could feel like they are pressured, they need to say something, or that they just parrot what the previous defendant says. The courts have acknowledged that there's a risk of that, but I think that the mere fact that there's a risk doesn't mean that we have to have a hearing in every case. It means that we should be sensitive to those claims where it's alleged by the defendant that that risk came into being and was, in fact, what governed the defendant's responses on that particular occasion. The risk might always exist of many things in all kinds of proceedings, but the risk alone is not enough to order a hearing. What we have to have is some allegation that the risk came to fruition and that it undermined the plea in this case so that it can't be relied on as a reliable guilty plea, which is what we don't have in this case. What we have in this case are the facts alleged in the motion that counsel only talked to him for a few minutes before the plea. Well, that's flatly refuted by the record wherein the defendant said, I met with him approximately 10 times over the course of 4 hours. Not only that, but we talked about the charges. We talked about the case. I feel like I've had enough time to discuss this case with counsel before I'm pleading guilty. I'm satisfied with counsel's investigation. I'm satisfied with counsel's representation. At every point down the line, this defendant, when he was answering a question that had been posed to the whole group, or when he was answering a question that began with the words, Mr. Ryan. And if you look at that, every time, I think there's just a handful of times where the court says, Mr. Ryan. And then the court asks a question, and he responds appropriately. And throughout the proceeding, he responds appropriately. At no point is there ever any indication of any confusion, a misunderstanding, and certainly no allegation in the amended motion that any of the answers that he gave were not true. Not because he was lying even, but because they were just inaccurate, because maybe he misunderstood the question, or he forgot what the question was, because since he was number five in the list, by the time it got to him, he was sitting there thinking, I don't know what the question was, I think I'll just try and say what the guy before me said. But certainly with regard to the question about the amount of time that he had spent with his attorney and the number of meetings, that answer wasn't the same as all of the other answers that were given by the defendants. It was unique and specific to his own circumstances. So the allegation that counsel didn't talk with him except for a few minutes before the plea was flatly refuted by the record. The allegation that counsel didn't discuss the substance of the case with him, also flatly refuted by the record. In addition to his general statements, the defendant talked to the judge and told him what he had done factually to commit the crime. He admitted the essential elements of the case. So what it boils down to is a couple of allegations that he didn't have a long time to consider the plea, and that he was concerned that he might have a very harsh sentence if he didn't accept the plea. Both of those things might be true, but they don't allege facts warranting relief in as much as there was no allegation that would lay error at the feet of counsel for advising him of those two facts. Counsel telling him about the plea agreement and what the state is offering is not error on the part of counsel. It's exactly what we expect counsel to do. Counsel warning him that he faces a very harsh punishment if he doesn't take the reduced charge on a Class B felony and goes to trial on the Class A felony is also expressly what we require counsel to do. There wasn't any indication or any allegation, for instance, that the state's case, that the state's evidence as to the Class A was weak and that it was unreasonable for counsel to come in and tell him, hey, you're facing a serious sentence. It may be that the evidence was extraordinarily strong, but the state was willing to give him a break if he would plead guilty. We don't have any allegations to the contrary, and it shouldn't be left to an evidentiary hearing to manufacture those things and flesh out the record. We should be able to look at the amended motion and determine whether those facts as alleged would warrant relief. With regard to the group plea hearing, I did want to point out that the court in the Roberts case did look at the fact that the plea in that case was taken as part of a group plea hearing. I looked carefully at the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion in that case and wasn't able to ascertain definitively whether the defendant had alleged in his amended motion that the group plea setting affected the answers that he gave in that case. To the extent that that might have been something that was argued on appeal as opposed to asserting the amended motion, the state's position would be that that should always be asserted in the amended motion before it's taken up as a factual controversy. But I would point out this as well. The allegation in Roberts was that the state had changed the plea agreement that had been agreed upon by introducing a very small change to the agreement, if recommended. It had to do with whether the defendant would receive certain relief as part of his sentence. And the court looked at that and said, you know, that's a small change. There was a lot going on at the hearing. The court looked at the totality of the record, also looked at the fact that, you know, an attorney standing there could easily miss that, but importantly, pointed out that the record reflected that in that case there were eight defendants who were pleading guilty. Actually, it started with nine, but one was removed from the process after something came up about the statements he had made to the police. Ultimately, eight pleaded guilty, and of the eight who pleaded guilty in Roberts, six of them were represented by the same defendant. The same defense counsel. And so defense counsel is sitting there representing six people, keeping in mind the plea agreements of six different defendants, and I think the court looked at those circumstances and said this small change in the plea agreement, as alleged in the motion by the movement, is something that could have been missed or overlooked by defense counsel under those circumstances, and so we are going to find that this record doesn't conclusively refute the allegation that the state changed the plea agreement and that counsel was ineffective for failing to recognize that and object and put a stop to it. So I think that the court can look at the totality of the record, and including the fact that it's a guilty plea setting, a group plea setting. In this case, unlike Roberts, the defendant was represented by an attorney who was representing only this defendant. He wasn't representing any of the other defendants. And so if there was any problem in the case, counsel was standing nearby and could have said something. But otherwise, the allegations are not, the factual allegations that are alleged here aren't implicated by anything that happened at the group plea hearing. Unless we're going to look at a group setting and say, well, we just can't trust the record that was made. Well, I think that that would be a mistake because we always rely on people to tell the truth. When they solemnly declare in court that they're going to tell the truth, we rely on them to tell the truth. If we're going to get beyond that, get behind that, there ought to be facts alleged telling us why we shouldn't accept at face value the thing that you said was true when you swore to tell the truth. I'd ask the court to affirm the motion court's denial of relief in this case, inasmuch as the defendant, the factual allegations were refuted by the record or otherwise failed to allege facts warranting relief.
Counsel argued that Mr. Ryan's claim has no merit. But before getting to the actual merit of the claim itself, this court must review the record. We do know that a coerced plea is an involuntary plea. And here, Mr. Ryan alleged that counsel was ineffective for pressuring him by only informing him on the day of the plea of a change in the plea offer and indicating that he would receive a harsh sentence if he did not accept the offer in the next few minutes. As in Roberts, this is about a change in the plea agreement or and the communication of that change to the movement or to the defendant in this case. We are asking the court to find that the record that was created through the use of this group plea procedure is not entitled to the deference that this court would give a record that was an individualized plea procedure. And that is because there are no individual personal inquiries of the defendants with respect to their rights, their right to a jury trial, the right against self-incrimination, the right to effective assistance of counsel, the right to counsel. All of those questions were asked as part of a group plea procedure involving seven defendants, of which Mr. Ryan was the fifth. The majority of those defendants had virtually the same answers to most of the questions. Given participation in this type of a group plea procedure, it is not difficult to conclude that the defendant might feel some pressure, some group-associated pressure to conform, that he would be more reluctant to speak up and stop the plea, to indicate to the court that there were problems because he or she may not want to interrupt the court and may not want to interrupt the plea of the defendant who's pleading guilty next to him and might want to get a speedy disposition of his or her case. Speaking up in court has with it brings to bear a number of concerns. For a lot of people, they have a fear of public speaking. In a group process, a person who has such a fear would also be less reluctant to speak up when he or she might have an answer or a comment. In conclusion, I'm asking this court to find that because this plea was taken as part of an inherently coercive group plea procedure, this court should find that the record does not conclusively refute Mr. Ryan's claim that counsel coerced his plea. I'm asking the court to reverse and remand for an evidentiary hearing.
Thank you.